It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, if you haven't yet decided what you want to be for Halloween, this weekend might be the time to do it. We'll talk to a Wisconsin costume shop owner about what makes a great costume, and you can share your best Halloween creations. First, President Trump is threatening to shut down the U.S.-Mexico border over a group of people fleeing Honduras who say they want to apply for asylum in the United States. The number of migrants is estimated to be in the thousands, according to news reports. They're traveling together by foot in what's been a week-long journey through Central America. Elise Cohen is an immigration expert and assistant professor of political science at UW-Sheboygan and UW-Manitowoc. Elise, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Glad to be here.
Well, these large groups of migrants, some have called them, described them as caravans of migrants. They make for a dramatic media coverage. Definitely, they got a lot of political attention. Can you talk about how they fit into the overall immigration story in the United States?
Yeah, that's a really great question. We have seen the numbers of people coming from what they call the Northern Triangle countries, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, increasing in recent years. And whereas in the past we saw a lot of the numbers of migrants were shaped sort of by the labor forces of the market, this really seems to be more about increasing levels of violence in those countries. So I think this group coming from Honduras right now, a lot of those seem to be fleeing this kind of kidnapping, threats of extortion, really fleeing for their life, or what we would call asylum seekers.
Can you talk about their legal status as they try to gain entry and maybe stay in Mexico or try to gain entry into the United States?
Yeah, when we saw a few months ago, back in April, a similar group, which media reports were calling a caravan, it ended up in it began in the thousands. It ended up more like 150 or so by the time the last contingent made it to the U.S. border. So I think we'll have to watch and see in the next couple of weeks how many from this group actually come to the U.S. border to try and request asylum. That's what they would need to do. They would need to do credible fear interviews with our Border Patrol and Customs, which is basically where they would be assessed in terms of whether they qualify for fleeing persecution or torture.
President Trump spoke about this at a campaign event in Montana this week. He suggested without evidence that Democrats were behind the flow of migrants. Here's a listen to some more of what he had to say.
As you know, I'm willing to send the military to defend our southern border if necessary. All caused because of the illegal immigration onslaught brought by the Democrats because they refuse to acknowledge or to change the laws. They like it. They also figure everybody coming in is going to vote Democrat.
Can you talk about what the president had to say and how U.S. policy may affect whether immigrants or migrants try to make their way into the United States?
Yeah, I think that's a really critical question with the timing of this. When we look at President Trump's tweet, you're absolutely right. He sort of blamed or linked this to Democrats, saying, I'm watching the Democrat Party-led assault on our country, so even calling it an assault by the Democrats. And he also said, you know, this is going to be an election of the caravan when he was speaking at the rally. So he's really trying to link this in the context of being about 3 weeks or less than 3 weeks away from the midterm elections. It's really clever in terms of rhetorical strategy because it's amplifying his law and order message, getting tough on immigration and border control. And this is something that we know political conservatives really like and value and appreciate, and a lot of his base in the Republican Party, it could really sort of motivate turnout in the November election among those voters if they feel like energized by this rhetoric. You also may have noticed in the tweet he talks about closing the borders, and that's exactly the opposite of what he accuses Democrats of supporting, which is open borders.
And what would that mean? The president talks about closing the borders. Does that have a technical meaning?
Well, I think the complete closure of over 2,000 miles of border that we share with Mexico is unlikely. So it's more likely that this would be a threat that he's using to try and get Mexico, the Mexican government, to cooperate to diminish the amount of these migrants that actually make it to the U.S. border. But most importantly, I think it really is the rhetoric of trying to rally his political base ahead of the midterms. When we have seen talk of closing the border, you know, what would that mean to have a total shutdown of our southern border? A lot of economists say that would be devastating. We have over $1 billion worth of goods and services that legally cross the border every day, and, you know, over 40% of our produce that comes in from Mexico. So I think it's not necessarily likely to happen, but more about the rhetoric and the threat of it.
Elise Cohen is with us, Assistant Professor of Political Science at UW-Sheboygan and UW-Manitowoc. We're talking about the large group of Honduran migrants trying to make their way currently into Mexico, many bound ultimately likely for the United States. You mentioned the president talking about relations with Mexico. He has suggested the NAFTA replacement deal could be on the line, depending on how Mexico handles this. Yesterday, the Mexican ambassador to the United States, Geronimo Gutierrez, was on Fox News talking about Mexico's response.
It was very clear that we need to follow a two-track approach. We need to work in development and help those countries, and we're doing. And we also need to make sure that laws are enforced, and that's also what we're doing.
Let's take that first point, working on development and help in those countries, meaning Honduras and El Salvador. What is being done? Is the United States involved in that kind of effort to try to address some of the things that are driving people out of a country like Honduras?
Yes, we do give a lot of aid to the Honduran government. There is some critique, however, of the aid that we give because there's some controversy with the newly elected president who came in last year. There were a lot of claims of election rigging and that this is really a corrupt kind of anti-democratic regime in Honduras. And by giving especially some of the military aid that we do as part of our foreign aid budget to the country, our administration may be kind of supporting some of his anti-democratic ruling styles. But we do know development is really crucial. When we look at the extreme poverty of Honduras, we see it's about two-thirds of the Honduran people that live in deep poverty, somewhere like 20% of them even in extremely deep poverty, like less than $2 a day. So this really is crucial when we think about not only the violence and the gang violence that's driving this, but also just basic, you know, ability to survive for the people that live there.
But I saw a quote from one of the migrants in translation. I'm cleaning up the language a little. If we're not hurt by the criminals in Honduras, we're hurt by the government in Honduras. This is part of why people are leaving. There's the criminality, but no recourse from the government to help them.
Yeah, I've heard similar quotes in interviews with people, not only in this group, but in groups coming from all of the Northern Triangle countries, including Honduras in the past, where they were asked, you know, well, what happens if you are detained or separated from your child when you cross into the U.S. irregularly or illegally? And some of those interviewees would say, well, there's really nothing scarier than my home, what I'm fleeing. So absolutely, this idea that for many of those, it may be a life or death kind of situation.
And for that second point from the Mexican ambassador to the U.S., developing Honduras, sure, but also a need to make sure laws are enforced. So what are the legal responsibilities of Mexico and the United States toward these migrants, and what are their legal rights to enforce immigration laws? They aren't open borders.
Right. That's a really great point, because we do have some sort of obligation under international law regarding asylum. It's sort of sketchy exactly what it means, but we know that there is a legal obligation at least not to return those individuals that are fleeing violence, harm, persecution, or torture back to the country which they fled. So that means that in practice, the Mexican government really should not be returning or deporting people back without first assessing whether they qualify for asylum. The same thing with the U.S. We should be doing those credible fear interviews and really making sure that we are not sending back or returning anyone that has credible fear of persecution. Where it gets a little more complicated is that we know in practice that doesn't always happen, and sometimes those credible fear interviews are either done very quickly or in a manner where it's not clear that there's really adequate due process.
Elise, as we wrap up, what are you watching for next, both with this large group of migrants and with policy toward people from these three countries in Northern and Central America in general?
I think the thing for people to watch on this will be what happens as the group kind of makes its way, because the first smaller contingent has crossed over the border into Mexico from Guatemala earlier today, and we have images of Mexican police with riot gear, heavily armed. So I think there are some concerns that there may even be an outbreak of violence between the migrants and the Mexican police forces. So that's really what I'll be watching for, to see how that unfolds.
Elise, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
That's Elise Cohen, political scientist from UW-Sheboygan and UW-Manitowoc. She was with us to talk about the group of Honduran migrants who have been traveling through Central America, many ultimately looking to apply for asylum in the United States. Right now, Halloween is creeping up on us, and for some people, thinking up the perfect costume is a big deal. We asked some of our colleagues about their favorite costume memories. Here's a few they shared. Shemaine from the news department says she dressed up as Pebbles from the Flintstones with a full-length fake fur skirt and a huge dog bone in her hair. Rachel, one of our producers on Central Time, dressed as Selena, the famous Latina pop star, by chopping up her sister's old prom dress, hopefully with permission. Eva from Audience Services said her mom once spent days creating a belly button costume, complete with lint from the dryer. And Maureen from Wisconsin Life likes to make her own costumes. Her most memorable one was a two-person horse costume with her husband. They won a costume contest with that. I want to hear from you at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. What is the best costume you've ever come up with? Any memories from when you were a kid or a costume-loving grown-up? Do you make your own, buy them from the store, and do you have a plan for your costume this year? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Lori Wanninger is the owner of Lori's Costume Shop in West Bend. The store offers costume rentals, custom costumes, and alterations as well. Lori, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
Well, thanks for taking the time. Now, I assume this is the peak time of year for you in the costume business, right?
Yes, it is. Busiest 10 days of the year.
And yeah, is it just around-the-clock insanity for you?
Pretty much, yep. We're up late hours getting everything ready, your costumes prepped to go out for the next day.
Now, talk about your approach to costumes. I understand you make a lot of your own there.
Yes, we do. Yes, I've been a seamstress since I was about 12, so I like to create them. They're a lot of fun. People give me ideas, they bring pictures in, or I just look on the internet and come up with what's up and coming or popular, and we create it.
Yeah, and so what goes into making a new costume?
Internet research is the main thing, and then we figure out what kind of fabric we need, and then we put it together with a picture, like I said, and we just kind of fit it to, we are a rental business, so we try to fit it to the larger size so we can make it smaller if somebody is a different size. So we have to consider sizing when we make them.
Now, are you a big fan? Have you always been a big fan of dressing up on Halloween?
Yeah, my birthday is the day before Halloween.
Oh, really?
Oh. Yeah, so it's been a thing for me for many years.
So what are some of your costume highlights over the years that you personally have worn?
We do a group. So there's always a group of us going, and we always it's a couple things that we pair up. And when you walk in someplace, there's 10 of us doing all of the same idea. Like, we all went as pirates.
Right, I saw a picture of that.
Oh, yeah. Or we all went as, like, Roman warriors or princes and princesses. So we just, you know, the whole group goes. It's more fun when you have a bunch of people.
And I understand you took over the store for somebody who'd been doing the same thing, making and selling costumes for a long time. Can you talk a little bit about the history of your shop in West Bend?
Yeah, Gloria was in West Bend for 27 years. She was 75, and she was retiring, and I saw this for sale sign, thought it would be fun, and we've been doing this for 14 years. So our store has accumulated probably 40 years worth of costumes.
Wow. And what are some of the things people are asking for in this last couple of years? What are some of the trends you see in costumes?
The tradition the last couple of years has been creepy, Halloween. witches, warlocks, skeletons, zombies. Yeah, for some reason, old traditional Halloween has come back.
Supernatural creatures.
Correct, yes.
I want to bring on a caller. We've got Barb with us in Brown Deer. Barb, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Do you have a costume memory for us?
I do. I grew up in the 1950s, and we didn't have a lot of resources. It was post-World War II. So dry cleaning came in paper bags. So we would, children would take paper bags, cut a hole for the head and the arms, and then we would spend probably 2 weeks with crayons and paint and decorate those bags, and that's what we wore.
That's great. And did you, they were all on themes, I guess?
I don't know about that. We just probably decorated whatever, and we would attach things to the bags. There was always some creative attachment, and sometimes that didn't always work out. It would be too heavy for the bag, and it would rip the bag apart.
Oh, but no.
you didn't care. You just were happy running out in the streets collecting your loot.
All right, Barb, thank you so much for sharing that. And Lori, that's part of the fun, right? The creativity, even if you're not working with real fancy materials.
Oh, yes, absolutely. If you love to create, you love to do Halloween costumes.
And have people come in looking for really weird, off-the-beaten-path over the years at your store?
Yes. Yeah. The world is pretty diverse. I think I've heard it all.
That's great. Barb, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking about Halloween costumes. You can share your favorite or maybe a Halloween costume mishap at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Lori Wanninger is with us from Lori's Costume Shop in West Bend. We'll go now to Frank in Appleton. Frank, hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What's your story, Frank?
Well, a few years ago, we were invited to a party, my wife and I found out about an hour before that it was a costume party for Halloween. I had absolutely nothing planned whatsoever, so I had to think pretty quickly. So what I did was I took my daughter's batting helmet from softball and wrapped it in foil, and it had a face mask on it to make it look like a different kind of helmet. I then took some cardboard and made kind of a breastplate out of it and wrapped it in foil, and then made a little flimsy wood sword. I then took three stuffed animal dogs and sewed them to the sweatshirt I was wearing, and I went as Three Dog Night.
Oh, it's a pun. I did not see that coming, Frank. Thank you so much. Well, I hope you went through with other people because one is the loneliest number. Frank, thanks a lot for calling in. Lori, I love it. The pun Halloween costume. I'm a big fan. I'm very uncreative with Halloween costumes. I'm a big fan when people can pull off that kind of visual pun. Is that something you've worked on in the shop?
Yeah, I've seen some of the, like the serial killer. You take a box of cereal and some forks or some knives. Yeah, there's always some fun ones.
Oh, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to Randy in Kaukauna. Randy, hi.
Hey. Well, mine was quite simple but effective. It was a totally white body stocking with fuzzy white slippers and a bright yellow gag wig, you might say, and I was going as a used Q-tip.
Ew. All right. Randy, sure, I guess that plays for the right crowd. Thanks a lot for sharing that, Randy. I appreciate that. Lori, I understand the slogan, kind of the motto of your shop is be someone else for a while. Why do you think we find it fun to dress up, at least on this one day of the year?
Well, incognito works really well. I think a lot of people like to be covered up to be somebody else, so you're freer with your person. I mean, you can walk up to somebody and they don't know who you are, and it's more fun to play something different than who you are every day.
All right, thanks for that call. We'll go to Chuck now in Madison. Chuck, hello. What was your costume?
I went as I made myself a life-size tomato soup can with hula hoops and wrapping paper, and my girlfriend went as Andy Warhol.
All right, and you were the art creation. How was that to move around in, Chuck?
Actually, I made it kind of surprisingly well. I used three hula hoops hooked together with clothes hangers. So it's sort of like an old barrel. You
okay.
know how those old barrels, people would wear a barrel?
Sure.
You know, when they were back in the old days. I made it sort of like that, where it clipped on... I wore a pair of shorts under it, of course, and I typeset net weight, and it looked like an exact tomato soup can.
Fantastic, Chuck. I love it. Lori, I mean, it's easy to just go and buy that plastic mask at the store, and I'll be honest, if I decide at the last minute to wear a costume, that's what I do. Talk about the fun in getting more creative than that, just getting something at the drugstore on the way home.
Duct tape is really popular, aluminum foil, cardboard,
Yeah, there's a lot you could pull together
with those raw materials. Now, and you do lot of vintage type stuff, I understand too. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. With 40 years with the collecting, we have a lot of vintage clothing and vintage suits and hats.
I think we have time for another call or two. Jeannie is with us in Sun Prairie. What costume did you want to tell us about, Jeannie?
My daughter, I didn't realize when I bought her a pony that they would celebrate the holidays and, of course, and have Halloween costume shows and stuff like that. So I took my white pony and sponge painted it like a Dalmatian and dressed my daughter up as Cruella de Vil.
Oh, that's fantastic. That sounds like a prize winner. Was there a prize involved here, Jeannie?
She won. She did win.
I love it. Let's go to Becca now in Elk Mound. Becca, hi.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I am an art and music teacher at McDonald Area Catholic Schools in Chippewa Falls, and we just got done with a team-building exercise for our teachers. And at one of my schools, we just completed painting on shirts that were all different colors, and they say crayon down the middle. So each teacher is a different color crayon. And then at the younger school, we just painted orange shirts to look like jack-o'-lanterns. So on Tuesday, we're all going to be jack-o'-lanterns, and on Wednesday, we're going to be a box of crayons.
That's fantastic, Becca. Thanks a lot for that story. Lori, just briefly as we wrap up, even at this stage in the game, are you still actually sewing and seamstressing costumes together?
Yes, we are.
It goes up, goes to the last minute for you.
All next week and actually even into the beginning of the next week.
Well, Lori, I will let you get back to work right now. Thanks so much for joining us.
Great. Thank you for having me.
And thanks to all for all of your calls as well. You can keep sharing your costumes on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We had Susanna here at WPR, did a Maude Lebowski costume from The Big Lebowski. We had a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle, Tyler. Carol in TV made her own leg lamp costume. Keep sharing your Halloween costume memories and or plans on the Ideas Network Facebook page. It's Food Friday, and we're exploring the wide world of winter squash. A simple roasted squash is a great comfort food this time of year, but there's a lot more we can do, ranging from pastas and flatbreads to soup and dessert. Lori Skelton is a classical music host at WPR and a Food Friday regular. She's been cooking, baking, and tasting and sharing a lot of squash this month. Lori, welcome back.
Wide, wide world indeed. I think I could have a different recipe every day from now through the end of February and not repeat this once.
And I'm a big winter squash fan, too. One thing seems clear. You gave us some background notes here. Not all squash is the same. Give us a sense of the variety in the squash world.
Okay. A lot of us got started with acorn squash, the acorn-shaped dark green squash. You think about that, you cut it in half, and once you hollow out the seeds, the flesh is fairly moist, and you've got a fairly large cavity once the seeds are gone. Obviously, that's great for stuffing, or if you don't want a lot of squash, you can just hollow that out. You go on to something like butternut. The flesh is firmer, drier, much smaller hollow for seeds, and those are easier to peel when they're raw. They make a great base for soups, and you kind of think about squash in terms of, is the flesh relatively dry? Is it relatively crumbly? Or is it going to be moister when you work with it? And that's how you go from there. Pick your squash, pick the profile you want. Do you want something that's got a little bit of moisture to it, or do you want something that's drier? And then go from there.
So acorn and butternut are the ones we see all the time on store shelves. What are some of your favorites if we want to branch out?
Okay, start with something that is called a carnival squash, or some other people call it a sweet dumpling squash. This is the one that looks like a smaller acorn squash. The flesh is white and speckled with green and yellow. They are smaller, so they're a lot easier for just one or two people to eat. That's going to have a slightly drier than acorn texture, but a sweeter taste than, say, butternut. That would be one to look for. There's a new variety of squash out. It's been around less than 10 years, but I know of three people at, for instance, the Dane County Farmers Market that carry either a honey baby or honey nut squash. It looks like a mini butternut squash with darker flesh, but it's only about 4 to 6 inches high. This is one that benefits from dry roasting, oven on high heat, and this will actually get like a caramel or a malty taste. Ooh. You almost don't have to add any extra butter or honey or maple syrup to it. That's a fun one. And something that I've loved for 40 years, of course, is spaghetti squash. This is the pale yellow squash where you cut it in half, you roast it in the oven, you scrape it out, and it looks like strands of spaghetti. You can eat it like vegetable spaghetti because this is going to be a moister squash. You'll probably want a drier, chunkier sauce with it. But my favorite thing to do, going back to the Moosewood Cookbook 40 years ago, is using that as the basis for a vegetable casserole. It's marvelous.
And what keeps some people, I think, from working with squash is peeling it. It can be a pain. Do you have any advice for us when we want peeled squash on how best to do it?
Okay. First of all, if you don't want to peel squash, start with the brand that's called Delicata. Not the brand, the variety that's called Delicata. This is an oblong squash, and the flesh and the skin is so delicate, you can eat that with the skin on. It's great roasted as well as stuffed. For the most part, if you're going to be peeling an acorn or a delicata or one of those big monsters like a Hubbard where you need to take an axe to it to cut it in pieces, it's probably best to roast it or steam it first. If it's a smaller squash, you can even throw it in the microwave for 8 to 10 minutes and then just scoop out the flesh from the skin. That said, hang on to the seeds and that stringy pulp and your skins because that makes the basis for a really great vegetable stock. You'll want to boil that down, reduce it, and then save it. Pumpkin stock, I found out to my detriment when I tried making a French pumpkin and white bean soup. If you don't reduce it, and keep reducing it, it does kind of taste a little bit like it's missing the earthy tones. So if you can hang on to your peels, make a big batch of stock, and really reduce it, you'll have an amazing base for soup.
It's Food Friday. Lori Skelton is with us. We are talking about cooking with winter squash. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite recipe to use winter squash? Do you have a question about how to cook with it? 800-642-1234. Let's get to a recipe that you pointed us toward, Lori. We talked to Lydia Bastianich. She was where you are right now, actually in the studio, and you talked to her this morning. You brought in one of her recipes to the office the other day. Actually, not just the recipe. You made the recipe, brought the food. We tried it. It was awesome. Marinated winter squash. This is at WPR.org/Food Friday. What's it all about?
I've known about this recipe for 10 years. Lydia has actually used it in more than one of her cookbooks. She loves this recipe so much. You take butternut squash, you peel it, and butternut squash you can actually peel with a vegetable peeler. Peel your butternut squash, slice that long, lovely neck into 1/3 inch thick half rounds, and then you fry those rounds in vegetable oil about 3 minutes on a side until they're almost done. You will then marinate those pieces of fried squash in a marinade that's made of reduced cider vinegar, a little sugar, a little salt, lots of slices of garlic that's sat overnight, and then you blend in a little bit of olive oil. All you need to do is layer the squash with the marinade, throw in some basil leaves, and throw it in the refrigerator and let it sit overnight. This is my suggestion for a very easy Thanksgiving side dish. Yes, you're using squash, but you make it a day in advance. It can be served at room temperature, and that reduced cider vinegar marinade is going to be sharp enough to cut through your gravy, your richer meats, without being so sharp as to overpower. I think this is a brilliant recipe.
It was a great mix of flavors. The smokiness of the sort of fried up caramelized squash, the garlic, the vinegar. It had a lot going on. But and basil too, right?
Right.
Yeah, but it all worked together.
I thought so. As I say, it's a recipe that Lydia Bastianich has used in more than one of her cookbooks. If you are not comfortable with frying things on the stove, give yourself a little extra time. Yes, it is involves a little bit of cleanup, but that's one dish out of the way well in advance of a big meal.
There's so many different ways to do squash. It's like potatoes. Like you mentioned the oven baking it. You know, you just put in a little water in a thing. I usually do all my squash, if I do it in the oven, a little bit of water in a casserole dish, whatever. Mm-hmm. Squash half upside down. little water. But you say sometimes we don't even need that water.
Again, with that honey nut variety, you want to dry roast that. You want to get that as caramelized as possible. I think it depends on every cook's preference, what he or she wants to end up with at the end of the meal. If you're roasting squash and you know you're going to stuff it, maybe you don't want to have water in that pan. You don't want to waterlog your squash if you're going to be putting a juicier filling into it. So look at what you've got to work with. Check the consistency of the squash. My go-to is, yes, turn it upside down in a pan with a little water. If you've got a drier squash, but you still want to add some moisture, cover your pan with aluminum foil. Then again, if you've got a moister squash that you want to dry out for whatever reason, maybe you want to use it for vegetable spaghetti, then go ahead and leave the foil off and don't worry about putting water in the pan. It may require a little bit of experimenting, but the lovely thing about squash is if it's left over and roasted, you can mash it up and throw it into almost anything.
Bring in a caller now at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us in Adams. Chris, hi.
Hi. Happy another gloomy day. well, it is fall in Wisconsin, right? People always forget about the season. I'm like one of those people that refuses to throw anything onto the compost heap or not. But there's a trick to making them, and I was going to suggest that people just throw the whole thing into the oven and roast it that way, because then your seeds steam inside and they're ready to go. But if you're going to split it in half and take the seeds out, there's a trick to making them. You have to put them in a very slow oven at the beginning until they're fully done, and then throw some olive oil and either herbs or some tamari on top of there, and they are so good for you. They're so healthy, and they're just a wonderful thing for you to have laying around your counter so when the kids come home from school, they stuff their faces with those yummy seeds.
You do them in the oven. Have you ever done them on top of the stove?
No, I haven't done that. But if you throw your whole squash into the oven to get it done, the seeds will just steam inside of there. So you don't have to even prep them in any way. You just scoop them out of there afterwards and throw them on a cookie sheet. That's okay.
What often happens when my boyfriend is making squash, he wants one kind of flavor on the squash and then a spicier flavor on the seeds. That's why he does his seeds on top of the stove. Say he's making cinnamon or ginger for the squash in the oven, he can throw some cayenne and chili on the ones on the stove.
All right. Thanks a lot for that call, Chris. We are talking with Lori Skelton right now about cooking with pumpkin and winter squash. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite thing to do with winter squash, whether it's sweet, savory, or in between? Tell us about your favorite squash recipe. Do you have some suggestions or some questions for Lori? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up a conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday. We're picking up our talk with WPR's Lori Skelton about using winter squash in the kitchen. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What great squash recipes do you break out this time of year? Are you like me and you're looking forward to squash season? Are you like me in any other ways? No, I don't care. Just the squash. That's all we want to hear about. Do you have a question for Lori about how to cook with squash? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Back to your calls now. Mark is with us in Oneida County. Mark, hi.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Mark?
Well, I use my butternut squash and my acorn squash, cook them down like you'd cook a pumpkin down, and then make pies out of them.
And squash pie works out well for you?
Well, have you ever had a sweet potato pie?
I have.
Well, it's pretty much the same thing.
It's probably a little bit lighter in texture, I'm guessing.
You know what? I can't tell the difference.
Oh, okay.
All right. Thanks a lot, Mark. So squash in pie, Laura.
Absolutely. Squash makes a wonderful addition to desserts. We had an evening at my house where people brought squash dishes over. Somebody made a galette, one of those open pie dough things with apple and squash and blue cheese, which was amazing. Getting back to squash pies, though, we all know what a basic pumpkin pie is. When I read the Little House books as a girl, there was one book where Ma made a green pumpkin pie. She took an unripe pumpkin, sliced it thin, layered it in a double crust pie with cider vinegar, sugar, and spices, and they tricked Pa into thinking it was an apple pie. I thought, okay, yeah, fine, this is a little bit of poetic license in the book. And then I read the exact same recipe in the Taste of Wisconsin cookbook from the State Historical Society. So if you have a green pumpkin or a green squash in your garden, go ahead and see if you can make a green pumpkin pie that tastes like apple.
Well, I'm going to ask the question everybody's thinking now. Why do they need to trick Pa? No, okay, maybe that's not what they were thinking.
They were surprising him, I should have said.
Oh, okay, great. Now, you meant to mention that galette, is that how we say that?
Galette.
Galette. Okay, we've got the delicata squash and apple galette. That's another recipe you set us up with. That's at WPR.org/Food Friday. Talk us through how this one comes together.
All right. This actually is a creation from Kirill Owen, a former technical director here at Wisconsin Public Radio. And she makes your standard 10-inch crust. She has apples with the skin on, delicata squash, again, with the skin on. You're slicing your squash and your apples about a half inch thick. Take the seeds out. Again, leave the skins on. You toss your apples with brown sugar, and then you alternate the slices of apple and squash on your dough. Put a little butter on top. Toss it into the oven. You may want to sprinkle vanilla sugar on top. Kirill suggests that when the galette comes out of the oven, then you put on your blue cheese dressing, then you know, let this cool down a little bit so it doesn't spread out all over the place. And she also recommends you sprinkle on a little bit of balsamic vinegar when you serve it.
Wow.
It's amazingly good.
All right, that's at WPR.org/Food Friday. Back to your calls now. Bill is with us in Wisconsin Rapids. Bill, hi. What do you got for us?
Well, first of all, listening to this program, I'm gaining 5 pounds just listening to all the tasty recipes. But I've got to say, with any fine meal, you do need a beverage to wash it down with. And I wonder if anyone has ever considered pumpkin wine.
You know, that's a really good question. I would tend to think this is not something that's going to ferment very well, but if someone is out there and you've actually fermented pumpkin, call and let us know. Here's one thing
I have. Yes,
all
back
right.
In the 90s, I made about 12, 13 different varieties of wine over the course of 10, 11 years. And one of the more unusual ones was pumpkin.
How
and
did it taste, Bill?
It was very interestingly subtle. I don't know if I even need to say it was difficult to describe, but I did make pumpkin wine. I also did some other strange things like tomato and potato, but that's another story for another program. But pumpkin wine was in there, and I would think you could use a similar fermentation process for any of the squash.
Interesting, Bill. Thanks a lot for our bold winemakers out there.
Wow.
Give it a shot.
Okay, I know what I'm going to be trying this weekend.
Where are you going to find? You're going to make your own?
I've got to at least give this a shot. I would love to try making my own now that I know that somebody says it's possible.
Okay, thanks. And we'll keep expanding our frontiers, Lori. Here's an email. Becca from Elk Mound called, couldn't stay on the line. She says she grew zucchini and pumpkins in her garden near each other. Now she has, she says, zumpkins. What should she do with them? Does this happen? Is this a thing?
A lot of squash does tend to talk to itself in the garden. And I think what you should do is, if you're picking this when it's still relatively green, treat it like zucchini. If, however, it's sat in the garden and it's developed a harder rind, then go ahead and treat it like a winter squash, because that's basically what winter squash is. It differs from summer squash that it's harvested and eaten when the fruit is mature. The seeds are fully mature, the rind has hardened, and also we know it's hardy enough to be stored over the winter. You can't put a zucchini next to your pumpkin in the root cellar and expect it to hold up. So see what the skin is doing. If the skin is relatively soft, treat it like a zucchini. If it's harder, treat it like a pumpkin. Just off the top of my head, I'd say what you should do is grate it, no matter what you've got, and put it into a muffin batter or a cake batter or a quick bread batter.
Quick bread, okay. All right. Well, and we'll send these zumpkins to the Ideas Network Biology Lab.
That's really cool.
if we had one. Back to your calls. It's Food Friday. Lori Skelton is with us cooking with winter squash. We've got recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. Mike joins us now in Glendale. Mike, what did you want to ask about?
Well, I was eating, I peeled and ate, was eating a butternut squash raw the other day, and I didn't know if you could do that or not, but it was good.
What possessed you, Mike?
Well, I was peeling it, and I was getting ready to cook it, and I took a bite.
And I mean, you're still with us, so that's a good sign.
Yeah.
Was it good? Was it a pleasant experience?
It was really good. I did it a bunch of times after that. It's very mild and very crisp.
Mike, thanks a lot for sharing that. Do people do this, Lori?
It's not done often, but yes, it is done. If you're not going to go the Lydia Bastianich route and make thick slices of squash that you fry before you marinate, get your vegetable peeler out, and then when you've taken the peel off, just go ahead and make thin curls of like a butternut squash and toss that with a very bold vinaigrette. Let it sit for maybe half an hour, and that makes a really lovely salad addition.
Get some onions and lime in there, and you got butternut ceviche.
Almost, yes.
Thanks a lot for the call, Mike. Thanks for sharing that with us. We'll go now to Gene in Madison. Gene, hello.
Hi there.
What did you want to ask about?
Well, I wanted to ask. I'm a big fan of seeds. Even when I was a little kid, I used to buy pumpkin seeds, covered with salt, of course. And now I'm on a low-sodium diet, so I have to fix it myself. And I've done it, but how in heaven's name is there an easy way to separate the seeds from the strings?
I guess it depends on your definition of easy. I don't think there is one foolproof way. I do think you have to. My favorite way to do it is get them in a colander, go ahead and rub the seeds against the rough sides of the colander, and that will usually get rid of most of the strings. That said, because again, you can eat these things raw, a couple of strings aren't going to kill you.
That's true. I mean, actually, sometimes the strings get nice and crispy when you're baking them with the seeds, and they can be the best part. Sometimes they're kind of gross and stringy, though.
But yeah, something that will crisp up and caramelize gives you a different flavor profile. I understand if they're getting stuck in your teeth, it can be a little bit uncomfortable. If anybody has got a better way, but my favorite way is just stick them in a colander, rub the whole mess against the sides of the colander, and that will usually get rid of the strings pretty quickly.
Thanks for your call. I've got a big pot of squash soup waiting for me at home that I made just the other day. Let's talk a little bit about, we've baked them in the oven with the water or whatever, but actually oven roasting, where we cut slices, toss them in oil and spices. I love it that way.
Oh, yes.
What's the best kind of squash to do that for oven roasting?
I prefer the dry varieties of squash, and here's where those honkin' big Hubbard squash, the ones that it almost takes two people to lift, this is where those squashes can come in very, very handy. If you can wrangle one of those on your counter and are able to cut it up and roast it, that is going to give you so much leftover, lovely roasted caramelized squash. You can either eat it on its own, toss it in with one of your sheet pan dinners, or then go ahead and put it in with your pancake batter, or use it for a soup, or how many different ways. You mentioned Lydia Bastianich. We haven't even talked about the number of ways you can put it with pasta. A great way to use roasted squash is to toss it with a sturdier, shorter pasta like orecchiette or penne, and you will toss that with a little bit of sage and maybe a sturdier green like kale. Start by roasting it and then just go crazy.
Lori, thanks as always for joining us. A lot to work with.
A lot. We'll have fun.
Lori Skelton is a classical music host at WPR and a Food Friday regular. She was with us today to explore the zillions of options for pumpkin and winter squash, zumkin, you name it, in the kitchen. You can find a couple of recipes that Lori pointed us toward over at WPR.org/Food Friday and share your recipes on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Celebrity couple update. Ariana Grande and Pete Davidson have broken up, and Kim Kardashian and Kanye West have not. And both of these pieces of celebrity news are being used to get people to register to vote. It works like Rickrolling, where people used to put up provocative links on Twitter and elsewhere that took you to a video of singer Rick Astley. But this time, the links are going to the vote.gov website. One example, people on Twitter started spreading a message that Kim was divorcing Kanye, but the link took you to the voter info site. One started here in Wisconsin. A social media director at Marquette University sent out a link with this caption, "Wow, I can't believe this is why Ariana Grande and Pete Davidson split up." That one got a lot of national attention, with tens of thousands of people clicking the link and again going to the voter registration page. Elle Magazine retweeted that Kim and Kanye link, which got some backlash for a media outlet intentionally tricking its readers. But none of those shenanigans from us here at Central Time. If you're interested, the How to Vote website is vote.gov. No tricks to get you there. And if I'm going to play a Rick Astley song, I will just play it. Never going to trick you all. Never going to make you sigh. This is Central Time. Never gonna give you-